Bible and how it, I've understood and relate to this book. So most of you have figured out by the name Heppner that I am Mennonite. And if you doubted that from just the name Heppner, I can point you to like the Epp and Dirksen and Friesen in my background as well. But I grew up in a denomination that also had evangelical Mennonite in the name. And as a kid, I didn't pay much attention to what was going on around me for about the first 18 years. So I often have to check out my perceptions with my sister about what, you know, was happening. And one day I remember asking her, so I kind of feel like we were more evangelical than we were Mennonite. And she just looks at me and she goes, oh yeah. And for a lot of you, you won't really under, and the tone of voice was actually more like she was 2 degrees away from saying like, duh. And a lot of you won't really understand what that means. But for the purposes of today, just understand that being evangelical just comes with a whole whack of cultural things that go with it. And one of them is being that evangelicals really, really, really love the Bible. So what that looked like for me was on Sunday mornings, I went to Sunday school and we began by singing songs that were often directly based on scripture verses. Then in class, we were guided to memorize verses and we were taught Bible stories and concepts. And in the main service, there were hymns based on the Bible, the liturgy always included a reading of scripture, and the sermon included a reading of a different sermon, scripture text, and then the pastor would teach from that text to glean the original meaning. On Wednesdays, I attended Pioneer Girls Club, and that involved more songs, more Bible memorization, and always a Bible lesson. During summer, I would go to Bible camp, Christopher Lake Bible Camp, and we would have chapel twice, once in the morning and then in the evening, plus, in addition to the chapels, there were cabin devotionals. All of this meant more songs, more memorizing verses, more telling us what the Bible had to say with us. So I got a lot of Bible. So it was during camp we got booklets during the cabin devotionals that invited us to take part in the scripture reading program at home, where we would receive more booklets and where every day we could do a Bible reading and some activity like coloring or a word puzzle related to that day's verses. And the emphasis on a daily devotional life was nothing new to me, because this is another really strong evangelical value. I may have already been trying to do that, something like that, to be a good little Christian. But to do that with booklets, well, like my little heart be still. So I quickly signed up, and over the next 3 years, I got these booklets by mail and dutifully did my readings and activities, and then I sent the booklets back. And then, one day in church, the pastor called me up to the front. The organization that ran the program had, unbeknownst to me, sent word to my church that I had completed the program, and they sent a reward. The pastor told the church about my accomplishment and presented me with this brand new Bible. Looking back at this now, I'm amused by a couple things. Given the nature of the program itself, you would have thought that maybe the organizers could have figured out that a Bible was for sure the one thing I already owned. The other is that the Bible is a King James Version, which is the perfect translation for any middle school-aged girl. Within this strong faith culture, I witnessed many friends and relatives go to a Bible college after high school, and I chose that direction for myself. But honestly, there was not a whole lot of thought that went behind it. And there, my swimming in scripture just became a full-on deep dive. And I took classes in systematic theology, and I bought huge concordance textbooks to explain what the original Greek and Hebrew meant in individual books of the Bible. And in our dorm rooms and our prayer rooms, we gathered around each other to further talk about what all of this meant for our lives. During my final year, I entered a Bible reading contest, and I won. I still remember the look on my professor's face, because she was my drama teacher, my public speaking teacher, and you know me probably as an expressive person now, but at that time of my life, like when I was 20, the Mennonite was still very much within me, and the ability of me to be expressive in any way was not there. But at that point, I just decided I'm going to give her, and she was just kind of like, "Whoa." When I was able to expressively read the Bible. So at that time, my prize was, wait for it, another Bible. And this time this is leather bound, and it's the Good News version with all those cool little stick figure drawings. And this is at that point in my life, my seventh Bible. And I had another two of just the New Testament. But again, it was really nice of the people running the contest to make sure that a senior taking her Bachelor of Arts in Biblical Studies had a Bible. So what happened for me was there came a point in my 20s that I was pretty much done. I wasn't done with God. I wasn't done with Jesus. I wasn't done with my faith journey. I just happened that I found I could no longer read the Bible with any interest whatsoever. I knew what it said, I knew what it meant, I knew how to apply it. I would try to read, but it was just dry and lifeless. And this was hard, because this idea of personal scripture reading was a value to me. And I wanted God to speak to me through this book, but it kind of felt like a conversation that was just being repeated. And it was like talking to someone with dementia the same way that you did last week. And this applied not just to my personal reading, but how I experienced church. And it's something that I've heard even expressed by other people. I have a friend who's said that if he goes to church, he can just kind of hear whatever the topic will be or whatever the scripture will be that week, and he can just lean over to his wife and tell her exactly what the 3 points will be for that day, and he'll always be right, and that she hates it when he does that. But I also have a particular experience that stands out in my mind, because there was a church I was going to quite a few years ago that was going to get a new pastor, and I was curious about this person, and so I went online to see if I could find out anything about him, and I found a YouTube video that someone had uploaded of one of his sermons, and it was on the Good Samaritan, and so I just kind of finally started watching, and it was the same sermon on the Good Samaritan that I have heard preached by different people for my entire life, because it's kind of like there's certain points that everybody seems to bring out about that passage, and it's always the same, and I know it. I thought for quite a while when I was explaining this part of my talk of wanting to be able to read and get something out of the Bible and not being able to, if I should address the question of why does it matter? And I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into this at all, partly because I wasn't sure if I wanted to feel like I should have to justify it, and partly because I didn't want to get sidetracked from what I really wanted to talk about this morning. But I do want to say this. Given my background, this importance of wanting to still find meaning in the Bible could be mistaken for legalism. And I really don't think it is, because the times I haven't been able to read and wanting to read haven't been surrounded by guilt for me. It's not about legalism. It is about longing. It's about wanting to connect with my God, my Creator. So this time period of difficulty with this book has really lasted for decades for me. But I feel like I'm starting to find my way out of it. And I didn't say to find my way back, because I think a key to finding my way to having the Bible once again be a source of inspiration isn't about going back, but to get out of the box it was placed in by narrow thinking and theology. I was brought up in a world that taught that we should figure out the one way that this particular verse and passage was meant to be and then be solidified on that. Diversity was not valued. It was really viewed with distrust and ridicule. Okay, in case you can't read that, what it says up on the back is churches and Christian movements throughout history on the whiteboard that the character is pointing to. And then he says, so this is where our movement came along and finally got the Bible right. And then somebody in the audience is saying, Jesus is so lucky to have us. And that is how I feel a lot of my experiences in church have been over the years, is like that people have felt like they know how everything that there is to know about the Bible. They have the right way of viewing things, and that all these other movements, nope, they got it wrong. And so there's nothing else to learn from the rest of Bible history, the other parts of Christianity. And so if there's nothing else to learn, there's nothing to explore. To also say that I'm starting to find my way out of it is not saying, here, I've solved all your relating to Bible problems for you this morning. This is just where I am now. Some things I've learned and some stuff I found helpful. A major part in this process was the shifting of my own worldview. This probably happened in stages, because if I look back over the years, I see the questioning and the searching me was never quite satisfied with the answers set before her. The analogy I think I tend to think of when I think of a shift in worldview is this little thing right here. It's called a Hoberman sphere. And this sphere is made up of a lot of interconnected parts. Our worldviews have a lot of interconnected beliefs and traditions and values. So at times when I've questioned the parts of my faith that were handed to me, I found that they didn't just sit there on their own, they were linked to other things. So I was actually raised in a culture of young earth creationism. And when I started to question that and believe that maybe evolution could actually be true, it was linked to the accuracy of the Genesis story then. And then that was linked to the idea of the inerrancy of the Bible. And then that was linked to the trust in my whole of Scripture. And then that was linked to how I would thought about salvation and my eternal destiny. So then when I started to question one thing, pretty soon the whole thing shifted. And that's why shifts can be a very disconcerting experience. It's like you just can't think about one thing without everything seeming to change. And we may have people in our lives who don't make these shifts, and honestly, I really don't blame them. I'm driven to be here because there's a part of me that has to have this intellectual integrity, but I really don't expect others to be driven that same way. I found that others have to have a foundation in their lives that is much more driven by connection and relationship, and the intellectual questions that drive me just don't seem to concern them. So God bless them in that journey, that's theirs. But for me, despite this discomfort of shifts, there have been benefits. Just like this sphere, this shifting worldview has maybe felt less tight and safe, but it's felt more open, and I've gained possibilities. Giving up things like inerrancy has meant that I can be less defended about Scripture and come to appreciate what it is. This slide is not that great. We tried to get it as much as bright as we could. There's a skeptic of Scripture that has come up with this. It's contradictions in the Bible. What is this? What this is these lines are different passages of Scripture, and the longer the line, the longer this is probably Psalm 119. I think that's the longest one in the Bible. And so every line is meant to connect one idea of Scripture to another that contradicts each other. Pretty impressive, eh? There was a time that something like this would have made me feel very insecure about my faith. Now I can just look at this and think, eh. In fact, like if I spent a little bit of time on there, like clicking through and seeing what they meant by contradictions, and when I was like more in my past, really really evangelical phase, I could come across certain things that I felt like were contradictions, and they would make me feel uncomfortable, and then now when I clicked on some of those, it's like, okay, what I would feel uncomfortable with. And the things, some of the, like they have those up there, but they also are are highlighting some things. It's like they have a much lower standard of what they feel are contradictions, and so they have some up here and some are there, and it's going to be like, okay, well, if that's your standard, like probably this whole thing should just be solid red already. So, yeah, it's not a big deal. But it brings to mind one of my an author and blogger I really like. His name is Peter Ahrens. He has this thing, the oatmeal analogy, and it goes like this. First, if I say I hate oatmeal, and then I turn to someone else and I say I love oatmeal, I'm contradicting myself. If I said 20 years ago I hate oatmeal, and now I say I love oatmeal, I'm not contradicting myself. Rather, my view of oatmeal has changed over time. Third, if I say I hate oatmeal, but my son says I love oatmeal, that would not be a contradiction. We are two different people voicing our opinions. And he says the Bible works much more like the second two examples and not at all like the first. We create problems for ourselves when we assume the first example is relevant. It isn't. But what happens is sometimes we have foisted upon the Bible this first example of as if the Bible is supposed to be that first example, as if everything is supposed to line up. Because we almost think like God should have dictated it to people. And I know God really doesn't seem to dictate things to me, so why would we assume that he dictated it to anybody else, even way back when? Peter Ahrens also has talked about having an ecumenical view of Scripture, thinking of Scripture like we think of church. Churches are full of people with different perspectives and opinions, but they all belong together. Even thinking of our church right here, we have people whose backgrounds, and this is just what I know of if I think of what I've heard people talk of, or even thinking of what I know of our last names, people whose backgrounds include Filipino, East Indian, Italian, German Mennonite, Portuguese, Scottish, French. Our walks of life include people involved in healthcare, social services, not-for-profit, the arts, running businesses, education, trades, and taking care of children. We find similarities in our faith journeys, but we are not carbon copies of each other. Some of us have profoundly different opinions, even on things that are very important to us, but we belong together. Similarly, the Bible does have different perspectives. It has different voices, but these voices belong in the same book. One thing I felt like I needed to do to be able to gain an ability to appreciate the Bible again was to hear from people who weren't from the same backgrounds as me. And so I decided to hang around with Catholics. And by hang around, I of course mean online, because I am an introvert. So let's not go crazy here. One of my sources has been Sacred Space, which is a site run by Irish Jesuits. And it invites readers to take a few moments out of their day to read and pray and spend time with God, including a scripture reading. It starts with prayer, and at one point in time, the idea of reading a prayer that someone else wrote would have really bothered me. Prayers said by the heart were valued, and prayers really didn't seem that real if they were someone else's words. An author by the name of Lauren Winner kind of changed that idea for me. She once wrote something that was to the effect of, if she didn't read her prayers sometimes, she probably wouldn't read at all. Within that site, they have guides for how to read scripture, and I want to tell you a little bit about one of them. Listening to the word. Read over the passage slowly, several times, and see if any word or phrase stands out for you. Stay with that phrase for as long as you like, before turning your attention to any other. The process is a bit like sucking a boiled sweet, or for you U.S. readers, a hard candy. Do not try to analyze the phrase, just as you would not normally break up a boiled sweet and subject it to chemical analysis before tasting it. Often a phrase will catch the attention of our subconscious's mind's needs long before our conscious mind is aware of the reason for the attraction. That is why it's good to remain with a phrase for as long as possible, without trying to analyze it. I may find all sorts of distractions running through my mind, but some thoughts, far from being distractions, can become the substance of my prayer. It is as though a phrase of Scripture is a searchlight, which plays upon my stream of consciousness, thoughts, memories, reflections, daydreams, hopes, ambitions, fears, and I pray out of the mixture of God's words my innermost thoughts and feelings. This is a very different way from how I was taught to approach the Bible in this exegetical fashion that I learned in Bible college. So sacred space also has a link that says needs inspiration, where they offer their own thoughts on the passage. And I found when I first started to use sacred space, my mind would so quickly go to what I was used to thinking about a particular passage, that using that need inspiration link helped me to get a different perspective and break out of that mold that I was in. But over time, I didn't always need to use it to have a fresh thinking for myself. Sacred space has been another form of community for me and a guide to show me a different way to think about the Bible. Another voice that really impacted me to read the Bible differently was the book, The Bible Tells Me So, and that was by that author, Peter Enns, again. He writes about how Jesus and Paul creatively interpreted the scriptures as they had at the time. They didn't try to follow the type of rules that we use, and if they had, they could never have had new ideas about who Jesus was and what life in him would mean. Theology and faith evolved. The idea of being able to approach scripture with creativity, to think not only of what did that mean then, but what needs to change because of our new understanding in this place and time, is an idea that refreshes and changes things up for me. And at one point, that would have just seemed blasphemous or heretical. But if this is how Jesus and Paul approach scripture, then why couldn't it just be a model for us? And really, it's bizarre to think that there's only one way to read scripture. A while back, I was in this conversation with somebody who came from a similar background as me. And we were talking about her kids and how they are questioning the faith that they grew up in. And then she turned to me and said, basically, so what about you? Where are you at these days? And that is something I am often really cautious about talking to people about because of the worldview thing and pretty much, not wanting to approach things with arguments or people or things like that. So I pretty much limited my thoughts to saying, you know, right now I have become really comfortable with uncertainty and that I don't have to know everything and that can be okay with me. And then she started to tell me that is why we have the Bible, so that we can know what to believe and we can be sure. And I really grew quiet because I didn't want to argue. But internally, I just felt this a little frustrated because I was thinking, you know what, you don't think I know this line of reasoning? We grew up in the exact same environment. We went to the same college. This is not news to me that this is the common belief that we all stood by. But it's just not enough for me anymore. But sometimes I need to have this, like a model for why I'm ticked off about something, even if it's for alleviating my own frustration. And so maybe you will kind of find this all helpful because I started to sketch something out. I thought about how when we approach the Bible, there's a matter of where we fit on a spectrum of beliefs, and I mapped out the following ideas. We have a lot of different Christians interpreting the same book and ending up in different places on a spectrum on three questions. The first question being, what do we take literally? We kind of all think about different things, that's what the dots represent, different things that we take literally. As a professor of mine liked to say, although the psalmist says he will cover you with his feathers and under his wings you will take refuge, there are very few people who would think that God is a giant cosmic bird. Some see the creation account and Jonah's story as historical, others as stories that help to bring us a deeper understanding of ourselves and the world around us. We can see poetry and hyperbole and metaphor and myth in the Bible without seeing those things as lacking as inspiration for us. There's also points in which we use our discretion. We use our discretion all the time. A.J. Jacobs, in his humorous memoir, The Year of Living Biblically, tried to literally follow all the Bible's directives for 12 months, and in doing so, he showed the reader that all of us actually don't live the Bible literally. We selectively pick and choose what rules and practices and guidelines we consider culturally cultural and relevant, and which ones we consider disposable. Yet sometimes we fail to see that our interpretation of those directives is just that, an interpretation and not necessarily held by others. And we hold to that interpretation as if it was handed down to us on stone tablets. And what do we add? We also add to the Bible. Most of us are not that keen on ideas like slavery, polygamy, and killing our kids, all of which are modeled and condoned in Scripture. But we've added ideals to Scripture that we hold quite strongly to because we believe that the better ideals of Scripture lead us to better practices. There are also groups that have personal preferences, such as believing that women should not wear pants or people should not use birth control. These things are not mentioned in Scripture at all, but firmly held in place by faith practices of those groups. So to say that this book will provide us with certainty is not correct. That doesn't mean it won't provide us with inspiration or guidance on our journeys. Things have shifted for me. I haven't been able to lose the glasses that seem to make me see every Bible passage in a certain way. And I've started to have some new perspective on things. I cycle a fair bit, and about a year ago when I was going through Bird's Hill, I was thinking and processing a lot of this information, and the thought came to me that I could take some time right then and there to read something. And then it was like, after that thought occurred, I was like, now? We're doing this now? And just a sidebar, these brain conversations that I'm having, I'm really not assuming to be anything in particular. I've always heard people my entire life saying, God spoke to me. And I've always wondered about how people seem so sure of that. And I have thoughts that seem to drift into my head, and I've never had experiences that are of such a nature that I ever say 100% for sure that God is telling me anything. But I wonder about it a lot. So when I have these random thoughts, I can wonder if that was, oh, was that God or something like that? I wonder if God has something to do with it, but I just have to say, like so much in life, I just don't know anything. So I did have this random thought that occurred to me, and it was just kind of like, okay, yeah, why not? So, okay, fine. I found a bench, and I was thinking then, okay, what do I read? And I was in a really, really bad mood that day, and I didn't particularly want to not be in a bad mood that day, so I decided to read Ecclesiastes. And there is no absolute agreement on the authorship of that book, but tradition has it that it's King Solomon. And so on that day, that's who I had in mind as the reader, the authorship of King Solomon. The authorship of Ecclesiastes as King Solomon. And that's kind of important to the story. So I'm kind of reading through, and I only had my smartphone along. So I'm just kind of going through this book. When you don't have the actual printed book in front of you, you're just swiping electronically, it's easy to forget how long some of these Old Testament books are. And so the writer, whom I'm assuming is Solomon, is just going on and on and on about life is meaningless, life is despondent, meaningless, despondent, despondent. Life sucks, okay, I get it already. And I'm not trying to discourage you from reading Ecclesiastes, I'm just saying this guy really knows how to have a pity party, and you have been warned. So, I'm reading along, trying to just not fall into any of the usual interpretation ruts, and then I come to chapter 8. And it goes, obey the king's command, I say, because you took an oath before God. Do not be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. Do not stand up for a bad cause, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since a king's word is supreme, who can say to him, what are you doing? Now, I'm a person who has some pretty negative experiences in the realm of leadership, including some workplace bullying, and I do a lot of reading about organizational dynamics and the exercise of power. So when I read that, my first reaction was to think, what a self-serving pile of crap. And that, in the way that I am brought up, that's not really a way I am used to looking at the Bible. I was taught to see it as having authority in my life. So the thing I should be doing with a verse like that is to think about who is a leader in my life and who I should be obeying and things like that. Because as much as I've heard it said that the Bible's not a rule book, it was always used as one over and over again. And verses that have been and are quoted to me are used to tell me what I should do. Now, Paul wrote to Timothy that all Scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching and rebuking and correcting and training in righteousness so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work. A word that he didn't use, though, was authoritative. As much as people try to tell me that the Bible is supposed to have authority in my life, I don't think that's what it's meant to do. I don't think a book can have authority. I think I have authority in my life. I mean, I think God can have authority in my life too, don't get me wrong. But being as I don't have this fantastic ability to understand exactly what he wants from me all the time, in every circumstance, I still have to rely on myself to discern what is best and hope I'm doing a good job. When people tell me the Bible is authoritative, I think what they mean is the way that they have landed on those spectrums in the Bible, the way that they see the world, is how they want me to see it too. And I'm quite convinced that they want to have authority in my life. I think of the books that Kathy has written, the Conversations with Monuments books, and how when she is writing those books and she goes into a city and sits down with a monument and thinks about what are the conversations that she would have with those people that are represented in those statues. That's kind of how I was thinking about that conversation that I was essentially having with King Solomon that day. I think that my faith heritage taught me that the Bible was to be this one-way communication where it was to teach me. But in that moment, it felt like I was able to have the type of conversation with the writer of Ecclesiastes because of having the Bible. I was able to question whether the instruction to obey leadership was self-serving. I was able to think about I was able to think about if being in places of power makes one more likely to cling to notions of obedience to oneself when one is feeling hopeless and despondent. Rather than just assuming a God directive of these verses, I let them have a different voice. Maybe that is where the inspiration is, because I'm not lesser than the author of the Bible. He was human, I'm human, neither of us are God, but we get to have conversations about spiritual things. And I'm grateful for the conversations I get to have, whether they're through this book with someone from thousands of years ago or my walk with a friend last week. I don't claim they're equally inspired, but I think they're both inspired. Since December, I've been going through a particularly difficult time with my mental and emotional health, and I've been pretty determined to address that holistically, focusing not only directly on my mental and emotional health, but also my physical and social and spiritual health too. I decided to take a shot at reading the Gospels, starting with Matthew, and I was really pleased to find that I was able to get out of some of those ruts of how I've always seen those passages. And what was particularly great about that is for a woman who is going through a divorce, there's certain parts of Matthew's that can leave one feeling pretty judged, but I came away from that feeling grace. A couple things. In Matthew 12, Jesus goes about doing things like pulling off the heads of grain and healing people on the Sabbath, and then challenges the Pharisees who challenge what he's doing that he's doing those things on the Sabbath with a message about the value of people. I thought about that for a long time, about how we value people versus valuing institutions, including the institution of marriage. No doubt the Sabbath may be important, but its importance was for us, to help us rest. And if observing it is hurting us, should that give us pause? And shouldn't that also be considered for marriage? Marriage was created as a bond between two people to love and support each other. And if that bond becomes something which is hurting one or both people, is it serving its purpose? Are we meant to serve the institution? Or is the institution supposed to be for us? And then there's this part where people directly ask Jesus about divorce. And Jesus seems more restrictive about divorce than the Old Testament regulations, which is really, really unusual. Jesus often seemed to value more freedom for people, not less. So in this case, one has to ask why he would do the opposite. I think important questions to look at are, who has the power in relationships? And what were the likely outcomes for women who were divorced? And note that only men could divorce women. Women could not divorce men, not in that culture. I think the most likely scenario is that Jesus was saying this in order to protect women in that culture at that time. I have a friend who works in victim services. In her role, she often works with victims of domestic violence. and in conversations will encourage them to leave relationships where they and their children are not safe. She has seen numerous examples of pastors and Christian counselors do the opposite with these same women, prioritizing the marriage over the person. I think it's a tragedy to take an ancient text in a culture where divorce has made circumstances worse for women, and then to use it to religiously bully women into staying in situations where their physical, mental, and emotional health is at stake, as well as that of their children. Every once in a while, I'm finding I get a message out of the blue from women I know, maybe from high school, maybe from my Bible college years, who have found out about my separation. And they either just want to talk about their own marriage that's not going well or about their separation and those issues. Churches and other Christians are frequently less than helpful. I'm finding I'm really particularly grateful for this journey I have been on, because it's giving me not only good things for myself from the Bible, but the tools for these kinds of conversations. I find I can keep in mind where they are on their journey. They don't have to be here. They can be here. And they can tell me about all the kinds of beliefs that are important to them. And knowing these things, I can try to help them find God's grace in these difficult situations. Maybe just by helping them find a little bit of movement, just enough for their safety and security. And that's been really good. That's pretty much what I wanted to share with you today. That's some of the main stuff on my Bible journey. And just that I really appreciate being in a community of exploration where I have a bunch of people who want to listen to me.